Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Stephen Dobbs, your moderator for tonight's program. It's now my pleasure to introduce our speaker. Stephen L. Pease is the author of, quote, "The Golden Age of Jewish Achievement, The Compendium of a Culture, a People, and Their Stunning Performance." Stephen Pease is a Phi Beta Kappa graduate of University of Washington and of Harvard Business School. He currently co-chairs the U.S.-Russia Foundation for Economic Advancement and the Rule of Law. He also chairs the U.S.-Russia Investment Fund. Now, these nonprofit entities are organized by the U.S. government to work with Russians and to encourage entrepreneurship, civil society, and the rule of law while also improving the U.S.-Russia relationship. He is a CEO, a venture capitalist, and community activist. And in fact, I see Stephen as an object lesson for us all, reminding that one is never too busy to lead several international organizations while writing a 622-page book. Stephen himself was raised Presbyterian, but he has had a long fascination with Jews and with an associated question, namely, how could such a tiny group of people — Jews represent 2% of the American population and an even smaller fraction of the world's — how could this almost microscopic minority have had such a major impact upon culture and society? The numbers are daunting. For example, Jews comprise 36% of the Nobel laureates in economics, 51% of the Pulitzer Prizes for nonfiction, 21% of all Ivy League university enrollment, and 37% of Academy Award-winning directors. Pease inquires, why are the Jewish people such disproportionate high achievers? He attempts to answer this question through hundreds of case studies in science, politics, law, sports, architecture, performing arts, finance, social activism, philanthropy, and a dozen other domains of singular accomplishment. But I'm going to leave it to our speaker to share with you some possible explanations for this high achievement. Finally, it's fitting that the Commonwealth Club is our venue this evening, given the Jewish cultural emphasis on literacy and education in creating this legacy of achievement. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Stephen Pease.
Thank you very much for that. I can't tell you how honored I am to have the opportunity to speak at the Commonwealth Club, to have all of you here, and to have the gracious invitation to be here. This is the second opportunity I've had, the first to involve Russia, of all things, of course. But tonight the topic is a little different. The Golden Age of Jewish Achievement. This is a very unusual book. It's called a compendium because the editor who said I didn't need an editor said, you got to call it a compendium. There's no other way to describe it. If it does what it's intended to do, and I'd like to think that it does three things, three unique things. It is the most complete description of disproportionate Jewish achievement that's ever been done. It's not the first. There was a time that my wife was busy encouraging me to get this darn thing done, or somebody was going to beat me to the punch, and I discovered on the internet there was, in fact, a book called Jewish Achievement. Nervous as hell, I ordered the book, only to discover it was written in 1910. So 100 years ago, somebody took another shot at this. It's a smaller book. It's only 125 pages as opposed to the 600 of this book. So the first thing the book does is to make the case, I think, as thoroughly as anybody has ever made it, of disproportionate Jewish achievement. The second thing it does is tell stories. In my view, human achievement is vitally important. It's what got us out of the caves. It's what cured polio. It's what's going to solve global warming. The nature of finding people who want to excel and do outstanding things for all of our benefit, I think, is very important. And to the extent that I'm involved in civic affairs in Sonoma, it's one of the small things that I worry about. I'm not quite as confident about the future as I would like to be. But the nature of human achievement is that it's particular, it's individual, it's unique to the person. So the second thing the book does is tell more than 400 stories of individual Jewish high achievers, some of whom it tells in a little longer, three or four pages, some of which are really quite brief. But the point is, human achievement is an individual accomplishment in the paradigm I'm writing in, and so I'm telling those stories. And it talks also a little bit about the culture of those people and what they perform. The third thing it does is try to at least provide my answer to why this may have happened. If you look at the top of the cover of the book, you'll see Rabbi Harold Kushner's name as an endorser of the book, and as I'll say a little bit later, he took a particular interest in what I was doing through the good offices of a fellow by the name of Ed Stolman, who happens to be with us tonight. And Kushner said, "Steve, you know, if you're going to look into this, I'm pretty sure you're going to find what you expect, which is disproportionate achievement. But for you, the question is going to be, why did this happen?" So the third thing the book really tries to do is get into the subject of why has this happened. I'm going to begin by reading two quotes tonight. The reason the quotes are particularly important is because they amplify what I mean by the Golden Age. Why did I call this particular book the Golden Age? And the Golden Age is really a phenomenon, in my view, of really the last 200 years. I mean, Jews have been high achievers for a long time, but high achievers in secular domains like the Nobel Prizes is really a recent phenomenon. The first quote is from Paul Johnson. Paul Johnson is a Brit. He's a Catholic. He wrote a book about the life of Christ in the 80s, and right after he finished that book, he decided he would write another book called The History of the Jews. Popular, sold lots of copies, somewhat controversial for some of the things that he had to say. But he makes a point. I'm going to quote. "Quite suddenly, around the year 1800, this ancient and highly efficient social machine for the production of intellectuals began to shift its output. Instead of pouring all of its products into the closed circuit of rabbinical studies, where they remain completely isolated from general society, it unleashed a significant and ever-growing proportion of them into secular life. This was an event of shattering importance in world history." The second chap is a Jewish fellow by the name of Raphael Patai. Patai wrote a book called The Jewish Mind. He looked into kind of the history of Jews and Judaism in somewhat the way that Johnson did, but took a slightly different spin because he was Jewish. His quote says, "In the wake of the Enlightenment, the suddenness with which Jews began to appear and make a mark in numerous areas is nothing short of astounding. It seemed as if a huge reservoir of Jewish talent, hitherto dammed up behind a wall of Talmudic learning, were suddenly released to spill over into all fields of Gentile cultural activity." Patai. Because I'm so used to this phenomenon, as I think most Americans are, to some extent disproportionate high Jewish achievement, I don't think we understand that for roughly the better part of 18 years, how much put upon the Jews were through most of the world. From the time of the Roman destruction of the Second Temple and the series of wars that they had, they were forced to disperse all over the planet. And they were, you know, while Muhammad called them the people of the book, he tried to convert them. When he couldn't convert them, he became very angry. Martin Luther tried to convert them. When he couldn't convert them, he became very angry. During the Crusades, they were assailed. During the Inquisition, they were assailed. It really wasn't until the Enlightenment, from maybe 1650 on, that Europe began to get through the religious wars and begin to say to the Jews, you know, I'll tell you what, maybe instead of us trying to force you to convert and do all these nasty things, why don't you come into the room and sit down and let's have a conversation. The Enlightenment led to the Jewish emancipation. The Jewish emancipation started about 1780 in Austria and was really, it really got its wings because of Napoleon. Napoleon took the view that Jews were really highly accomplished people. He convened a Sanhedrin in which the Jews had to say that they would be loyal to the country that they were a part of. And so he made it happen almost all over Europe from roughly 1804 till about 1880, when almost every European country had allowed the emancipation. Jews could vote. They could join the military, they could hold political office. All these things really did not exist until the emancipation and the Enlightenment. And Jews responded to that in part with a reform movement that moved some of the religious practices closer to kind of the nature of Christianity. So what I'm saying is around 1800, a phenomenon occurred in which Jews began to participate in secular life. That's what the two quotes are about, and that's what I'm writing about. How I got here, I'm going to grab some water. Why would a kid from Spokane, Washington, who grew up as a Presbyterian, get interested in this topic and write about it? I guess from the time I was a kindergartner, I had some Jewish friends and acquaintances. I mean, I had them in grade school. I had them in high school. When I went to Harvard Business School, we shared a common bathroom facility, and out of the eight of us, three of them were Jewish. But when I went to school, you know, you were talking about dates, you were talking about current affairs, you were talking about everything else except Jewish history and Jewish culture. But I had an inkling. But after spending some years as a management consultant, after spending years as the head of corporate planning for a Fortune 500 company, I wanted to get into line management. And the way I could do that was by moving to Miami, Florida in 1972. This was a company that was a partial subsidiary of a Bay Area company, which is the way I got there. But I inherited a boss who was about 6 years my senior, who was very smart and very tough and very Jewish, secular Jewish. And he taught me more than I learned in the Harvard Business School in the time that I was there. He was a very demanding boss. Many of my direct reports were Jewish. We had a cadre of salesmen that were all aggressive, one-call, closed Jewish salesmen. I was 29 years old. You can imagine the fun they had with me, testing me every day of the week. They would take me out in the field and try and put me in embarrassing situations just to see how I would respond. It was a Jewish industry. Most of the companies that were in the industries were started by Jews. And during the first 15 months I was there, we were acquiring companies in the industry. And my partner in that is a fellow who happens to live in the Bay Area now, but he was a New York attorney with the firm of Skadden Arps at the time. And we went out and acquired these companies. And Ted is now a friend of going on 40 years. One of the companies we acquired, this was the real estate information, was a company in Los Angeles. David Nitka was an Israeli whose parents went to Palestine in the 1880s. And David fought in Haganah during the War of Independence. And then when the war was over, he had to come to the United States to get an education. And when he did, he met this charming little Hungarian Jewish girl who was an American. And so he was stuck. He was here. And he was probably the leading technology guy in the real estate information business. And like Ted Kozloff, the attorney I was talking about, David Nitka now is a friend of almost 40 years. So in that 6 years, I developed a real appreciation of a group of people that I thought were full of life, were vital, and I thought through that entire time period, if I could get somebody to give me a list of the 100 most accomplished mathematicians, the 100 best physicists, the 100 best this and that, if I could really look down that list, I bet you I would discover that a disproportionate number of them were Jews. But I had to earn an income. I had to, you know, have a career. I had to do all kinds of things. So there was really no time for me to do that, and the tools weren't available at the time. If I'd have got the list, I don't think I could have identified who was and was not Jewish. But in 2002, my mother became ill with what was ultimately diagnosed as Alzheimer's, and the nature of her illness was such that I had to be available to go and come from Spokane on short notice, which meant that I could not take on a full-time assignment at the time. And while I was involved in Sonoma and while I was involved in Russia, it did give me the time to take a look at this phenomenon, to kind of dig in to this question of disproportionate achievement. And I was very fortunate because the Internet really provides an astonishing tool for providing these lists. I mean, you can find out the list of, you know, who competed in the 1916 Olympics on the French team in this particular sport. You can find it on the Internet. It was never there before. The other thing that you could do is you could generally identify who was and who was not Jewish. Now, my point was not to out people who wished not to be outed, but you could find out fairly readily who was and who was not Jewish. And as I began to develop this, I shared a little Excel spreadsheet that I had done with Ed Stolman one day over lunch, and I didn't know it, but Ed then delivered it to Rabbi Harold Kushner, and Kushner really became quite intrigued by it. And Kushner tried to get his publisher to publish it and his agent to be my agent, and they both said, sounds like a nice magazine article, which is a very polite way of saying, no, thank you, we're not really particularly interested in it. But Kushner's question of why is part of the reason this all took so long, because I could have finished the basic statistical research relatively quickly, but getting into the question of why for a Gentile who knew a little bit of Jewish history, but not very much, that took some time. What did I find? I'm going to give you some statistics, and then I'll give you some stories. The Nobel Prizes. The Nobel Prizes began about 1901. They are, as you probably know, overseen by the Swedes and the Norwegians. This is not something that Americans select. If you took all roughly 781 of the Nobel Prizes that have been awarded from 1901 until now, and you looked at the number of Jews in the world, you would expect them to get fewer than two of those Nobel Prizes. As Steve alluded to, if I assembled a group of 1,000 people in this room that were intended to represent the world's population, and I had them for tribe, ethnicity, language, and so on, out of that 1,000 people, two would be Jewish. Only 0.2%. Now, if I did the same thing for the United States, 20 of them would be Jewish, 2%. So when you discover in the Nobel Prizes, 781 prizes, and they should have earned 1.8. But in fact, they've won 181 of them. It's more than 100 times more than you would have expected. They've won 23% of all the Nobel Prizes ever awarded. And in fact, interestingly, since the Holocaust, that number has gone up. They've earned more like 27% in the years since the end of World War II. great inventors. You would expect them to be fewer than one of Encyclopedia's list of the great inventors. I said 13-7 in the book. What I didn't know until afterwards was that I missed more than one. The guy who put the rivets in the Levi jeans was also Jewish, Davis. So the number is higher than what I show here. But 5% of history's great inventions have come from Jews. There, as Steve said, 21% of the Ivy League, our best schools, 2% of the population, 21% of those students. They are now half of the presidents of the Ivy League schools. That's actually down one. When Larry Summers left Harvard University, it went down from 5 out of 8 to 4 out of 8. John Bates Clark Medal, this is the precursor to getting a Nobel Prize in economics. It's limited to people who are under the age of 40. These are the brilliant minds that are going to set the future in economics. 67% of the John Bates Clark's medals have gone to Jews. Pulitzer Prizes. I don't think anybody looked at this one before I looked at this one, but when I began looking at the history of the Pulitzer Prizes, I discovered that 51% of the Pulitzer Prizes for nonfiction have gone to Jews. Kennedy Center Honors, performing honors. You're up singing, you're dancing, you're telling stories, you're playing a musical instrument. They've won 26% of the Kennedy Center Honors since inception. And if you took this, all of the symphonies in the United States from the date that they began and looked at the conductors over that period of years, they have been the conductors of the major symphonies a third of the time. Academy Award for Best Director, 37%. CEOs of major corporations, study done by a Harvard professor in 1997, he reckoned that it was about 22%. Now, that's also an interesting number because it was surprisingly high in 1905, but if you look at the list in 1905 and 1907, they were all entrepreneurs. If you look at the list in 97, you discover that they're moving into the chair of Fortune 500 companies, Hewlett-Packard, places like that. So they increased their numbers, and they took over more of the seats like Shapiro did of E.I. DuPont, which had been family-run for years. Forbes 400, an astonishing number. 31% of the Forbes 400 are Jewish, mostly because they're entrepreneurs. These are people who made a fortune with an idea and built it to become a major company. But the next number is even more interesting. Business Week each year does a survey of the 50 most generous philanthropists in the United States, and they look back 5 years. It isn't just a one-year phenomenon. It's retrospective for 5 years. The last two of those, 38% of the major philanthropists in the United States were Jewish. So they are rich because they make money, but they are more philanthropic than they are rich. Ladies Home Journal looked at the leading females in the United States some years ago, and no surprise, 20% of them were Jewish. More. Jews are terrific entrepreneurs. Every Hollywood studio was either started by or shaped by Jews, even including the Walt Disney Studio. Walt Disney was not Jewish. He was accused of being anti-Semitic, which I don't believe he was. The data seemed to be pretty strong on that. But when he died, that studio was floundering, and they brought in Michael Eisner, and Eisner just revolutionized the place. I mean, within 15 years, it was 10 times the size of what it was when Walt passed away. I'll tell one more story about Hollywood here as we get into some of the personalities. All three of the radio and television networks were started by Jews. General David Sarnoff was responsible for NBC and ABC. I mean, he's the guy who saw in the science of dots and dashes, the Marconi wireless, what could happen in broadcast radio. And he became the first effective head of RCA. And he built NBC Blue and NBC Red, and they became ABC and NBC. He was also the first guy to realize what television could become. And in RCA, he built that. Half of all the major department stores are specialty retailers founded by Jews. Even R.H. Macy. Roland Macy was not Jewish, but he sold out to the Strauss family in the 1880s, and they're the ones who really built that chain. In finance, it's names like, in high tech, Intel, Google, Oracle, Microsoft. Microsoft is not Jewish, but Ballmer is, and he's been there from the very beginning. Dell, Qualcomm. And when I finished this chapter, and some people were telling me about it, they said, Steve, if anything, you understated that phenomenon. And that's true. In part, that has to do with education that I'll be talking some more about a little later. In finance, it's Goldman Sachs, Rothschild, Warburg, KKR, and in recent infamy, Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, a number of them. They've been in finance for hundreds of years. Activists, in my view, Tikkun Olam, a duty to heal a broken world, has helped make Jews amongst the most activist people on the planet. Gompers, you know, a labor union leader in the early 1900s. Gloria Steinem, just one of a number of leading Jewish feminists. Saul Alinsky, you know, Obama and Hillary Clinton share an interest in what this guy has written. In fact, they follow some of the precepts that he's got. Rubin, one of the Chicago Seven. Noam Chomsky, linguist, an activist on the MIT campus, and Andy Stern, the most frequent visitor to the Obama White House, who just recently announced he was retiring from the public American Public Service Employees Union. The largest unions in the United States right now are public employees. The person responsible for that, more than anybody else, is Andy Stern. So you have this history of being involved in activist causes. Olympic athletes, a surprise. I think most people don't think of Jews as athletes because they aren't. You don't see them in the NBA. You don't see very many of them in some professional sports, although interestingly, in professional baseball right now, they are proportionate to their numbers. But if you look at Olympic athletes, they picked up 401 Olympic medals, seven times what you would expect. Part of the reason people don't understand that or appreciate that is so often they were doing it for a country and they were identified with the country, but not as Jews. 54% of the time since the international chess champion was declared in 1866, they have held that title. And in the last Senate, not the Senate that's convened right now, but in the prior Senate, they were 11% of the senators, 6% of the House of Representatives, and they were, until the last week or so, only two of the nine Supreme Court justices. But if I had to bet, I'd say in 90 days they will be a third. And somebody asked me in a radio interview if I thought that was crazy, and I said, not really. You realize if you look at the faculties and the students in law schools and the members of the major law firms, I think you discover that that proportion is roughly in line with the number of Americans who practice law. Roughly a third of them are going to be Jewish. Two-thirds of the Broadway's longest-running musicals. You know, most of those major shows on Broadway came from that. The stories. The book begins many chapters with profiles that may go two or three pages of some leading personalities that you would know about, Milton Friedman, Barbara Streisand, Sandy Koufax, Andy Grove, and so on. And often they're there to kind of tell a story about the personality, but also the culture that they came from. You know, Andy Grove's Intel story coming out of Hungary, you know, 1956 and so on, how he, more than anybody in my view, he built the culture of Intel. So that and maybe hundreds more. I'm going to tell you two of these stories, one a person you would know about, one a person that you wouldn't. Lev Levayev, most of the people in this room would have no idea who in the world Lev Levayev is. Lev Levayev is single-handedly rebuilding Judaism in Russia. That's the reason I got intrigued with him. Levayev is a guy who was born in Tashkent, Uzbekistan. His father was a rug merchant but a hidden rabbi. This is 1956, 3 years after the doctor's plot. They didn't like the fact that they couldn't practice. They finally got out in 1972. Levayev, being Levayev, he's apprenticed to learn one part of diamond cutting. Instead, he cuts a deal with his classmates, and he learns all 11 steps. And so immediately when he graduates, he sets up a small business. He doesn't believe in leverage, and so when the price of diamonds went down, all of his competitors started to get creamed, and he bought them out, and he became the leading entrepreneur and the major export from Israel in the late 70s and the early 80s. In 1985, Mikhail Gorbachev came to power in the Soviet Union. Gorbachev believed that the Oppenheimer Diamond Cartel was taking advantage of the Russians. And he heard about Levayev and asked Levayev if he would come. Levayev said, no, I don't know. He asked his father. His father said, I don't want you to go back there. But go talk to Rabbi Schneerson. This is the Chabad sect of the Hasids. If Schneerson says you can go, you can go. So Schneerson says, yes, you can go. But if you go, don't forget where you came from. So he went, and he did explain to Gorbachev how they were being taken advantage of. He provided lots of advice. He had been an Oppenheimer site holder. They cut him right out of that equation the minute he was cooperating with the Russians. But the relationship that he formed with the Russians was such that when the Russians fell on hard times, he, Levayev, was the guy who would go in and provide the financing for their partners, such as in Angola. He made himself immensely wealthy, roughly $5 billion worth of net worth. But in 1991, 1992, he wanted to do a synagogue and a school in St. Petersburg, and the mayor said no. But the deputy mayor, a fellow by the name of Vladimir Putin, said, oh, do it. So he went ahead and did it. In the last 10 or 12 years, Levayev has been spending roughly $50 million a year to rebuild Judaism in Russia. I mean, so many Jews left to go to Israel. The numbers that are left are 100,000, 400,000. Some people think it might be as much as a million, but that's a very liberal interpretation. A lot of the intelligentsia moved out. This guy is trying to rebuild it. And he is so significant in there that when Putin had a falling out with an oligarch and fired the official rabbi of Russia, it was Levayev's guy who came in. This guy, little known, rebuilding Russia, rebuilding Judaism in a very interesting place. The second story I'll tell you a little bit about is a little more conventional. Most people in the room probably know that Al Jolson did The Jazz Singer. You may not know it was done by Warner Brothers. And it's a fascinating story because it tells of two families and the dilemma they were going through in terms of assimilation in early day Hollywood. Al Jolson was the son of a cantor. And as the son of a cantor, he was expected to join the synagogue and be the cantor when his father stepped down. But Jolson discovered that he was a good entertainer and he liked entertaining and people paid him to do that. And his father was really angry about that. But Jolson became well known and very popular, and a fellow by the name of Raphaelson wrote an article about it that appeared in a magazine. And Jolson got wind of this story and approached Raphaelson to see if he could buy the rights to it, and Raphaelson said, no way, couldn't do it. He didn't want this turned into a Broadway musical review. But the Raphaelson story ended up being a play on Broadway, and I believe George Jessel, if I'm not mistaken, was the person who played what really was Al Jolson. This was really the story of Al Jolson's life, but Jessel did it, and he refreshed his belief in Judaism by playing the part. Break. Niles, Ohio. The Warner Brothers are four brothers from an impoverished father, and they're in the business of running Nickelodeons, by which that they were renting movies, short movies, 5 minutes, 10-minute movies, and then they would rent halls all around them in Ohio, and they would sell tickets and sell out the Nickelodeon. Then they decided that wasn't as good as owning the movies, so they started buying them, and then they would show them, and then they would rent them. But like lots of the Jewish entrepreneurs in the Hollywood experience, they decided that there was no future in this. The only way you were going to make money or you were going to survive in film was to become a producer. You had to produce what today we would think of as feature-length films, which is a big part of what the Jews brought in the creation of Hollywood. And so two of the brothers, two of the Orthodox brothers, who moved to New York and did the finance, and two of the unorthodox brothers went to Hollywood and started making the movies. They bought the rights to The Jazz Singer. The interesting thing is that the four brothers seem to have a bit of a disagreement about what the movie was supposed to be about. The ones in New York expected to tell the story that had been on Broadway, which was that Al Jolson decides it isn't worth it, and he goes back and he becomes the cantor. The two brothers in L.A. were making the movie, Jack Warner and Sam Warner. They did it their way. No, he's going to go back and he's going to sing Kol Nidre that night, but the next night he's back on Broadway. So what the story was all about was the story of Jolson's fight with assimilation and fight with his father that was also going on in the Warner clan. But the other thing that was going on was that the Warner brothers decided that they would make this into a sound movie. Now, it wasn't very long. It wasn't that big a part of it. And there had been some segments of sound in some prior movies, but this became the sound movie that everybody related to. Ironically, none of the Warner brothers made it that night. One of the brothers, Sam, died the week before. He'd been working on the movie, the stress, everything. He was gone. So none of them were there. But it revolutionized Hollywood. Hollywood had been thinking about sound for 40 years. They'd explored it, particularly for the last 10. Nobody had done it, but the four Warner brothers did it. And it made what were a group of four parvenus into a powerhouse. Within the space of about 3 years, they owned over 500 movie theater houses. They were the major production studio. They were today's Time Warner. And in his time, Jolson was as popular as any entertainer on the planet. Why did this happen? There are a lot of theories, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time going over each of them. I think we can rule out luck, because if luck was what it was about, you have to explain the bad luck that they had for the better part of 2,000 years. There was a theory that maybe it was because the meritocracy in medieval Europe in the Catholic Church meant that you would become a priest, and maybe you'd become the Pope. But that meant that you had to be celibate. Well, there may be something to that, but remember, the Eastern Orthodox Church always allowed the priests to be married, and after the Reformation, so were all the Christians. There was a difference in the sense, however, that the rabbi, who was the intellectual leader in the community and the political leader in the community, was expected to marry. He often married the prettiest girl or the wealthiest girl in the community, and they had large families. So it helps. Survival skill after 2,000 years. I do think the survival skill certainly contributes to these entrepreneurial talents, figuring out how to survive, how to build a business, how to get things done. Second-generation immigrant, a theory I never heard before. The publisher of Forward one day in New York said, oh, we all know that it's a second-generation phenomenon. Nobel Prize laureates all believe it's second generation. If you came from the Pale of Russia and arrived here between 1880 and 1924, and your family arrived illiterate, you know, they couldn't read or write, that second generation was really motivated to perform, and they did. And so that was a prevailing theory. However, it doesn't explain how the Nobel Prizes have gone from 23% to 27% after 1945. Those are not second generation immigrants. This is a phenomenon that endures longer than that. Genes, there are a lot of interesting theories about genetics, some of which have some aspects of being correct, but you also realize the Palestinians share a lot of the same genes, and so far at least the Palestinians, though they are entrepreneurial, don't have anything like the performance that the Jews do. There were three professors at the University of Utah who made an argument that Ashkenazi Jews have high intelligence, and you see it also in some of the genetic ailments that Jews get, and it's high IQs, and therefore that's why it is. And the difficulty in part that I've got with the argument is that the Jews at the time that this all began were Sephardic Jews, and the Jews that are today's high achievers are mostly Ashkenazi Jews. The Ashkenazis seem to have entered the scene maybe about 800, 900, at least people being aware of them. But if you go to Israel today, as I have, in Israel, the Sephardics are generally thought to be the underperformers and the Ashkenazis are the high performers. So if it's solely a matter of genetics dating back to the Roman Revolution or the Roman Wars, it's not really explained. Malcolm Gladwell wrote a book called Outliers. He says what you need is hard work, 10,000 hours, circumstance. You got to be in the right place at the right time. Bill Gates was in Seattle in a school that had a computer terminal at the time that the industry was just beginning. Voila, hard work. And the other is culture. The last half of his book is about culture. I would make the argument that I think he's got some great insights there, but it doesn't explain the Jewish phenomena. All the Jews didn't happen to be at the right place at the right time. It just didn't happen that way. Culture. I think culture is the single most important phenomenon, and I'm not going to spend the rest of the time that we've got together going over this entire list. There are about 13 or 14 cultural values that I think the Jews have in combination that are unique to Jews, but individually, many cultures have them. There's also a few historical phenomena that are part of this as well, but I would like to talk for just a second about one of them, and then maybe if there's time, we can talk about a couple more of them. Education. The Roman Wars probably lasted from about 70 AD to about 160 AD, and when the wars were done, more than 1 million Jews had been killed. During that era, the rabbinic Judaism took over from the Sadducees, and the rabbinic Judaism was a more intellectual as opposed to a priestly religion. They had a problem. The Romans were dispersing the Jews all over the planet. They were going to be left as small enclaves, dinky, tiny percentages of the population, wherever they went. How are you going to keep that tribe, that culture, all these people engaged as members of that culture when they're spread out all over the world? They already knew they had lost the first 10 tribes. The first 10 tribes, when the Assyrian conquest came in 750 BC, those 10 tribes disappeared from the face of the world. Now, it may be an apocryphal story, but it's believed. So rabbinic Judaism decided education would be mandatory. What they did was, we know that parts of the Torah, Deuteronomy probably existed in some written form, 600 BC and so on. Parts of the Torah were all kind of in writing, but the rest of what we Christians call the Old Testament, what Jews call the Tanakh, had never been canonized before, and rabbinical scholarship said it's got to be canonized. We have to put it all down and agree that that's what is in the Bible. Then they did something else which was really kind of revolutionary. I didn't know this till I got into my research, but there's a thing called the oral law. Supposedly everything that Moses heard from God on Mount Sinai, in addition to the Ten Commandments, was the oral law, was the oral tradition. And historically, it had to be kept oral. It was prohibited from being written down. But after the Roman conquest at the beginning of the diaspora, rabbinic Judaism said, no, we've got to write it down. Now, there was another aspect of this, which was maybe to quell the debate, because there was a lot of debate about the oral law, but the point was, it had to be written down. It was the way in which the tribe, the religion, the culture could be preserved across hundreds, thousands of years, and across thousands of miles, because it was in writing, and if it was going to be in writing, that meant everybody had to be able to read it, write it, debate it, and discuss it. So for a tribe that was essentially a tribe of farmers, they made literacy mandatory. And 800 years later, you're here, when Maimonides, great philosopher, writer, physician, is writing, he's saying any town that has Jews that doesn't have a school, get rid of them. Any family that's not educating the kids, banish them. They don't belong. In 1880, the first real waves of Jews out of the Pale, what I call the third wave, the third major wave of Jewish immigration, began to arrive in the United States. 2 million Jews arrived in the United States between 1880 and 1924 out of the Pale of Russia. When they arrived, they were mostly illiterate. Lithuania was a place where a lot of Jews could get an education. It was fairly liberal, but most of the Pale. This is a lot of Poland, a lot of Western Russia. They were in shtetls. They had no education. They were relatively illiterate, and they were thought to have low IQs. when they arrived. They were doing IQ testing within one generation. Within one generation. They were 20% of the student population at Harvard University. They were 40% of the student population at Columbia University. They were 80% of the population at Hunter College. And mind you, this wasn't just an American phenomenon. This happened in Australia. This happened in Argentina. This happened wherever Jews were. And the research that I've done on Russia, because I'm particularly interested in the place, is that they did it there. They did it there even before they were allowed to live there when Soviet communism took over. You would find disproportionate numbers of them who were well-educated. Education today, 25% of the American population has a college degree. For Jews, that number is north of 50%. An astonishing number of them have advanced degrees. It's part of the reason that they are high-tech entrepreneurs. I'll close with that. I'm going to give you one last quote, and then if you have some questions about all this, I'll be delighted to talk to you about it. This is Mark Twain. Mark Twain said, quote, "Properly, the Jew ought hardly to be heard of, but he is heard of, has always been heard of. He's as prominent on the planet as any other people, and his commercial importance is extravagantly out of proportion to the smallness of his bulk. His contribution to the world's list of great names in literature, science, art, music, finance, medicine, and abstruse learning are also way out of proportion to the weakness of his numbers." Mark Twain, Harper's Magazine, 1899. So with that, thank you very much. I really appreciate your being here.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker is Stephen Pease, author of The Golden Age of Jewish Achievement. We are discussing the role that Jewish culture has played in achieving disproportionately high results. Well, Steve, there's a lot of interest in this topic, I can tell you from the questions. And why don't we just plunge right in? And I'm going to start with what might be a kind of tough one, which in your view, having spent so much time looking at what you call disproportionate achievement, are there any negatives to that? A few people suggest by their questions that perhaps it's not a good idea to feature and bring out and shed light on the fact that the Jewish people in so many of the domains and case studies you described are high achievers. Is there anything you might call negative high achievement?
I think it's a question. It's one of the issues that I've had in pulling the book together. There are a fair number of Jews who are really uncomfortable about the topic for that reason. I mean, if 2,000 years of history have taught them anything, they get invited in because they have skills that nobody else has to bring to a place like Poland or Lithuania or whatever. They get invited in for those skills. When things are going great, everybody's fine, everybody's happy, but when things start going bad, guess who the first scapegoat is? I mean, they were invited into places to become tax collectors for the king. He wanted to have somebody who could do math, who could go out and collect the taxes. You can imagine then how the locals thought about the Jews when times got bad and all of a sudden these are the guys who got all the money. So the history has taught a lot of Jews that keep your head down. And a book like this, which kind of says, look at all this. This is a pretty astonishing phenomenon. Does run that risk, and I'm sympathetic to it. By the same token, my point is exactly the opposite. I mean, my point is, look at this phenomenon. There is so much that we can learn from this phenomenon. There's no reason that other people can't be high achievers. And, at least somehow over the period of the 2,000 years, the feelings of anti-Semitism are still there, and I'd like to think maybe I could nudge it a little bit in the other direction. That doesn't mean I will. That's part of what I'd like to think that I'm trying to do.
I assume, though, that from what you said, that you would not want to cite, let's say, Bernie Madoff a disproportionate high achiever.
Actually, there's a whole chapter in the book called The Bad Guys and Gals. Right. And I really do believe that I couldn't be viewed as having intellectual integrity if all I was doing was telling the happy stories. So Madoff made it into the introduction of the book, and in fact, I write a whole thing about him and identify a fair number of Jewish bad guys. I mean, I'm not trying to say that these people are genetically unbelievably gifted and all the rest of us are just a little, the fact that they've earned 23% of the Nobels means that everybody else has earned 77% of the Nobels. They're people just like all of us. They have bad guys. The reason that there are a lot of them in finance is that many of them are in finance because they study, they go to school, they learn this kind of thing. You know, when you look at it, you don't find that they're disproportionately bad guys at all. And they have very low rates of things like murder. I mean, they're so low crime rates.
And yet, a lot of people might say they've been disproportionately preyed upon and have experienced more than when people share of the very worst things.
Absolutely.
In fact, one of the members of the audience says, despite these contributions to society, which you've been talking about, why are Jews so maligned and mistreated?
You know, in my view is when you look at this and the success that they've had for... Somebody said, look, Steve, don't worry about the book because the people who are going to dislike them don't read the book. You know, the point is that, yes, the jealousy is there, but you got to dig behind it. You got to find out why it really occurs. And I'm saying, look, when you've got this kind of education, when you've got this kind of family motivation, I think Jews believe, in my view, in cultural values, it's what you do in this life that matters. So they're really dedicated to make a difference in this life, and they do believe in progress.
Here's another question. Your list of cultural values includes many that are shared by other groups and other
Absolutely.
People. Which ones do you think have the most impact on the disproportionate success? So that if we were comparing Jews to others who also, let's say, have a high regard for education, why is it that the disproportionate outcomes exist if others are also pursuing the same values?
Well, I mean, this gets into some controversy. The fact that you believe it's what you do in this life is what matters. There are some religions that believe it's what you believe. If you accept a certain set of beliefs, you're going to go to heaven. That's all that matters. Just count on it. They don't believe it's what you do in this life. It's what you believe. There are some people who believe that life is an endless series of circles. There's some people who believe that if it's merely a matter of accepting, being resigned to what the world is all about and kind of becoming passive, that that's what's going to work. But I think for Jews, the point is, it's what you do in this life that matters. They believe in progress. They believe in ethical accountability. I mean, like I said in the beginning, there's nothing unique about any one of these cultural values. The combination for Jews may be somewhat unique, but my message is more people can be high achievers. Try to understand this phenomenon and look at what they did and see if there's things that you can apply to yourself and other people.
Your talk focused mostly on the individual. What unique qualities do Jews possess as a group, like how they interact, how they help and encourage one another, and how might these more collective values contribute to disproportionate success?
To some extent, part of my answer would be that all of these cultural values tend to be shared. Not every Jew believes in all of these, but many of them are shared. I mean, family values. I mean, while I was out partying on Friday nights and dating, they were home for Shabbat in family conversations. I mean, Jews tend not to drink as much. They are very family-oriented. They set up charities, and the charities they set up in the early 1900s weren't just for Jews. Those lending societies would lend to anybody. This whole Tikkun Olam, the duty of many Jews feel to help heal a broken world, I don't think those are unique. They're a set of cultural values that many Jews share, and it motivates them.
Everyone in this room is familiar with the long debate about nature and nurture and what the source of a particular set of talents which lead to achievement might be. What's your position on the way in which nature and nurture might affect this development of high achievement?
I think there's something to both of them. I think nature tends to set a broad parameter within which people can perform, and to some extent nurture has an awful lot to do about how you do perform within the constraints that you've got there. But I also would make the point that if you go back to some of this, the debate about the nature of Jewish high achievement, some people would argue it's really DNA because Jews all self-selected. When literacy became mandatory, a lot of Jews presumably opted out. You're a farmer. Why do you need to be literate if you're out there kind of tending the crops? And Charles Murray, who wrote The Bell Curve, argues that part of what happened here was that Jews self-selected for high IQs because the ones who wanted to become literate were the ones who went on, and the ones who opted out and stayed farmers left the religion entirely. Now, if that's true, and it may be, I mean, some people argue that's too short a period of time, you have the perfect interaction. The reason the high IQ exists as a phenomenon of nature is because in the nurture phenomenon, education became mandatory. So neither one of these things operates in independence, but I think my thesis is, of the two of them, in this case, culture is more important.
Well, there's apparently a cynic out there who is wondering about your development of the category sports. And the question is put to you is, how many successful Jewish professional athletes are there, really? Maybe you could say something about how that myth has prospered?
Not many. It is interesting, though, if you look at the National Basketball Hall of Fame, the top 10 winners of the recognized leaders, two of the 10 are Jewish. Surprise. Now, part of the reason for that is they count coaches, Red Auerbach, people like that. In today's professional sports, there's almost none of them in basketball, period, full stop. Coaches, but no players. In football, there are a few. There might be 10 out of the roughly, I think there may be like 700. But in baseball, professional baseball right now, they are proportional to their numbers. And in terms of sports ownership and in sports coaching, they are wildly disproportionate. The owners of most of the NBA teams, the National Football League teams, they are Jews, and many of the coaches are. So they don't participate as much, although they're involved, but not as much as some other people.
You can read the book and hear more about this.
Yes, they were boxers and basketball players.
Joseph Choinsky.
Exactly, yeah. In fact, in basketball, there was a team, I think the Spas, the Philadelphia team, and these guys were wildly successful, and they were short. And everybody said, how is it possible for these short guys to be such great basketball players? And so the idea was, oh, they got very quick legs. That's how come they do it. And like you said, in boxers, in fact, there are some prominent boxers today that are Jewish. I want to say Yuri Foreman. I could be wrong about that name, but he's a heavyweight fighter. So there's about four or five Jewish boxers on the scene right now.
So we're going to leave sports for at least a moment. Several of your listeners today are interested in the distinction between Jewish religious life and Jewish cultural life, and whether making this distinction you can describe different impacts. Or to put it another way, what seems to be behind the question is, do you believe that Jewish religious life is in any way a source of that disproportionate achievement, or does it come more or less exclusively out of culture?
Well, to me, this was one of the more... When I began this process, I thought the religion was really key. That, you know, I was worried about the decline in the religion because I thought the religion was driving the values. As I did more of the study, the more I became convinced that it is important, but there are an awful lot of other historical phenomena that caused it to happen. Half of all the Jews, I believe, and Steve, you can correct me about this, but I believe fewer than half of American Jews are religious, and the same thing is true in Israel. You know, the state of Israel was really formed by the Sabra, you know, the secular Jews who came there. They formed an accommodation with the Orthodox Jews to get the state established. But Israel is more secular than it is religious, and the same thing is true in the United States. And this has been going on for a long time. And to the extent it's been going on for a long time, you have to say that the secular Jews who are not religious are just as driven as the religious Jews. I would make a case, I may not be right on this, but I think I am. The ultra-Orthodox are probably among the lower high achievers because they tend to be a faith-oriented group. They tend not to be as rigorous in their academic performance. So you find amongst the conservative, the Orthodox, the Reform Jews, and the secular Jews, they tend to be more the high-performance Reconstructionist.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker is Stephen Pease, author of The Golden Age of Jewish Achievement. We are discussing the role of Jewish culture and how it has played an important aspect of helping to achieve disproportionately high results. You made the remark, Steve, about identifying people as Jewish, and that as in the course of your research you were able to decide whether someone belonged in that particular category. But you didn't explain at the time, and now I'm giving you a chance to do so, exactly how you did find out who was Jewish. And one of your listeners in particular wants that question posed to you now.
Well, as I said before, if the book errs on either identifying too many or too few, it identifies too few. A lot that I missed. Also, I never intended to out anybody. I mean, there are people that I strongly suspect are, but until I could come up with two or more sources that said that was true, I didn't say it. But usually what would happen is, I'll give you one small example of a major way that you find out. The New York Times now publishes every newspaper that's published from 1880 on. And if you're a subscriber to the home delivery, you can have access to that entire repertoire, which means that you can read the obituaries back in... I read the obituaries of the Strausses who went down on the Titanic. And so you can find out the rabbi who married them and when they got married. GuideStar is one of the leading places to go for all the nonprofit organizations in the United States right now and to look at the 990 forms, which is the tax filing forms for every 501c3 in the United States. A small example. Dan Snyder, who owns the Washington Redskins, is not really out there in the way that Mortimer Zuckerman is out there. But when you look at the Form 990, what you discover is that both he and his sister have a family foundation, and they are very generous philanthropists for Jewish causes. So what I'm saying is a little bit of creativity. There are all kinds of things on the Internet that allow you to do that. Like I say, I tried to be judicious. If somebody really preferred not to have it be out, I just forgot about it.
How did you deal with the various distinctions and differences in definition, which are commonly used, particularly in the popular press, in dealing with the issue of who is a Jew? Or the question for you would be, who is a Jew for the purposes of your book?
Yeah, I didn't. Meaning if somebody's a half-Jew, my view was that they probably have grown up in a cultural milieu that has these values. I wasn't going to worry about whether or not the mother was Jewish or the father was Jewish or both parents were Jewish. Katie Lang, the country western singer, has one grandparent that's Jewish, but she thinks of herself as being a Jew. And on my list of country western singers, female, she's the only Jew. She self-identified as a Jew, so I counted her. So I wasn't worried about whether or not they were Orthodox, and it was just their mother who was Jewish.
Until recently, Stuyvesant High School in New York City, a school for outstanding students, was disproportionately Jewish. Today, it is disproportionately Asian. Is it possible in the United States that the golden age of Jewish achievement is waning, and might it be succeeded by disproportionate achievement by others?
In 1945, Jews were 0.4% of the world population. Today, they're 0.2% of the world population. The last chapter of my book raises that question. Is the golden age coming to an end? When I was in Israel, I met with the head of the School of Medicine at Ben-Gurion University, a very charming female doctor, who said, "Steve, I'm really worried about our country. Our kids are becoming just as internet savvy as any American. They're wasting their time. All they're interested in is entertainment. I think they've lost their motivation." I've got a cardiologist in San Francisco who I think is a terrific cardiologist who's Jewish, and he said, "Look, Steve, when I went to medical school, half to two-thirds of all of my residents, all of my classmates were Jewish. I now teach. I'm at UCSF. 10%? It's all Asians. The Asians are coming to the fore." And I think this is a phenomenon and Confucian values also treasure education. Mom and dad are at the table with the son, encouraging him on. And so, yes, I think there's a very real risk. I don't want to say it's for sure, but I would tell you an awful lot of Jews also share the same concern I do, that this thing may just dissipate over time. Now, they've resurrected themselves many times, but it's a concern.
This is a kind of a difficult question, so I beg your indulgence. The Holocaust killed 6 million Jews, but some had the foresight, it is perhaps, I guess, presumed by this question, to flee. Is there something different about the ones who left? Perhaps their gene pool, their IQ, they were smarter in some way, they're more driven to success, had stronger will to survive. Why is there a disproportionate number of gifted Jews who got away?
I honestly don't have the answer. There are also stories of people who got out, one that I think Steve probably knows better than I do, who got out not because they were smart and wanted to get out, but because their parents said, "Get the hell out of here." So it isn't just a matter of people self-selecting. There were an awful lot of stories of kids who were taken out because they saw what was coming. You had a phenomenon in which an awful lot of people thought Germany was the most hospitable place on the planet for them and it was going to be okay, but it wasn't okay. I don't think that necessarily it was survival skills that got them out. There was a certain faith that it was all going to work out, and it didn't.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker is Stephen Pease. Our thanks to Stephen, who is the author of The Golden Age of Jewish Achievement, The Compendium of a Culture, a People, and Their Stunning Performance. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Stephen Dobbs, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club. of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you very much, everybody. Really appreciate it.